Heretic here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm John Batchelor. I welcome my colleague Michael Toth, research director at the Civitas Institute, University of Texas at Austin, writing most recently in the Washington Post about a term of art I discovered late in life applied to my experiences in university. It's called disparate impact. It has a negative and positive ability to discriminate without naming names or without being caught. Here's my anecdote. Michael, a very good evening to you. Reading your column in the Washington Post about disparate impact, and especially about the Ivy League, I entered Princeton in the fall of 1966, and I was puzzled. Eventually, I became friends with some of the Princeton entries, and they made remarks, one from Los Angeles, that he was unusual in his classmates entering into Princeton. Everybody else had gone to Harvard or Yale or Cornell because they were Jewish. And I went, what? What is this? I didn't say anything out loud. I just puzzled about it because I came from Lower Merion High School and Balakinra Junior High School, Philadelphia suburbs. 75-80% of my class was Jewish. And they all went to very good universities, some to Princeton, some to Harvard. You understand, these are the 60s. Now I learn from you that the discrimination exercised by Princeton and other Ivy League schools for the balance of the 20th century was disparate impact. How did they do it, Michael? What was the goal here? Good evening to you.
Oh, it's great to be with you again, John. And yeah, thank you for highlighting the piece in the Washington Post. You know, when it comes down to it, it's real simple. And I think John Roberts, our great Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, just put it so well a number of years ago. And this quote has been repeated and re-repeated and really ought to be written down as one of the great lines from any Supreme Court justice, which is the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. It's so simple. You know, we have a colorblind constitution in our great country. Our court has embraced that over the past 15 years. We have federal law that says very plainly you can't discriminate on the basis of race or religion, right? You talk about the Jewish American experience. Well, how did it happen? Again, the law says you can't discriminate. Okay. And so that's got to be the target. If we see discrimination, we've got to say it's wrong, it's against the law, and we've got to root it out.
And this is 1966, and entering that class. So it's 2 years since the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, 1 year. It's right. It's fresh in everybody's mind.
100%. And what we had for a large portion of the 20th century was the use of geographical quotas as a way of screening out Jewish students. And we also had the use of, and this is really unseemly, personality tests, which reemerge applied to Asian American students in the Ivy League before the Students for Fair Admission case, you know, stopped those practices in 2023. We just had the third anniversary of that. And so, you know, the really important thing, though, I think for your listeners is if we look at the Civil Rights Act in 1964, it does not prohibit disparate impact. It prohibits discrimination, right? So discrimination, when a decision maker, when an employer, when a university, when the government decides it wants to treat people differently based on their religion, based on their race, based on their sex, whatever it may be, that's protected by federal law. If their intent is to treat people differently, that's wrong. That's against the law. And it doesn't matter how they do it, whether they do it directly by saying, we don't want certain students of certain backgrounds to come, or they come up with a proxy. If it's discrimination, in other words, it has the intent to treat people differently, then it's against our colorblind constitution. It's against the law.
Therefore, the way that the admissions office did it was that if you were from a certain neighborhood in Brooklyn, you were guaranteed to be Jewish. Is that how they would make mistakes, but they didn't care, I guess.
Exactly. They're using the zip code as a proxy because they wanted an outcome which was based on inequality. They wanted an outcome which was not based on merit. They wanted an outcome which was not based on, mm-hmm. we want the best students, we want the best outcomes. They wanted an outcome that was sort of based on this idea of discrimination, right? And so that is, you know, an obvious problem when the law needs to protect equal opportunity, when the law needs to be colorblind, when we really anchor ourselves in this idea of merit, self-determination, of equality under the law, of treating everyone equally based on the content of their character, use another great phrase. What we've seen, so that's sort of the, that's the negative use of disparate impact as kind of a proxy for discrimination. Now, recently we've seen something different, and my piece in the Washington Post also talks about this, which is really the incorrect use of disparate impact. So I think what a lot of your listeners may also be familiar with is, you know, after the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964, the federal government, it started in the Nixon administration, it started in a Republican administration, led by a Princeton grad, George Shultz, who was the Secretary of Labor under Richard Nixon. And we started to see the shift in the federal government, where the federal government started saying, if there are unequal outcomes of employment criteria, which are truly colorblind criteria, criteria that are truly based on the qualifications that we need for an employment. Nevertheless, if we see unequal outcomes based on truly equal criteria, that's a problem because there's a disparate impact in those, you know, truly equal criteria that are put into place. Now, that is a real problem, right? Because what that's saying is, the legal error is not discrimination. The legal error is unequal outcomes, right? But the Civil Rights Act and the colorblind constitution and this idea of treating everyone equally means we're all going to start under the same standard that's an equal standard. Where people end up after that is really based on, you know, their merit. It's based on their skill. It's based on their effort. It's based on their determination, et cetera. So what we started to see from the federal government, and it starts initially in the federal government in the Nixon administration, was something called the Philadelphia Plan, which was this idea that the racial and the ethnic composition of workforces needed to mirror the local population, right? And then that became sort of the rule for all federal contracting. And this persisted from the Nixon administration through the Reagan administration. You saw Ed Meese, our great attorney general under Ronald Reagan, really said, you know what, it's time to end these programs of racial preferences through this kind of disparate impact theory. It continued even through the first Trump administration, 9 consecutive presidencies. And finally, in the current administration, there's been a whole of government approach to root out racial preferences from federal contracting, from small business programs, from Defense Department programs. And then most recently, the Justice Department, in a very important memo, which I focus on in the Washington Post piece, instructed the EEOC to stop this incorrect usage of disparate impact, to basically say any unequal outcome is therefore discrimination. No, discrimination is the intent to treat people differently. If that's what a criteria is doing, that's a problem. If the criteria is truly even-handed and we have unequal outcomes, that's a consequence of a free society.
There is a court case, 1971, Griggs versus Duke Power, and you report that Congress codified the result. What is it, and is that a challenge?
Right. Well, it's a couple things. You know, the Supreme Court in 1971 was not the Supreme Court of today. The Supreme Court of today is committed to a colorblind constitution. And so what I point out in the Washington Post piece is the Justice Department right now in the current Trump administration is not saying we can't have any disparate impact analysis. What they're doing is anchoring it back in the text of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And they're anchoring it in the principles of a colorblind constitution, which the U.S. Supreme Court has reiterated on many occasions recently, including earlier this term. And so a proper application of disparate impact theory will catch the kinds of things that you saw, John, when you showed up at Princeton in 1970, right? Which is the use of, you know, these geographical tests as sort of a quota to try to keep out individuals of certain religious backgrounds, right? That is an improper use of a criteria because it has a discriminatory intent. So that application of disparate impact theory is the application that the Justice Department in their memo is saying we can go forward with this. And so that's a way of sort of looking at what the Supreme Court did in 1971 and making sure that it's compatible with the current Supreme Court's correct understanding of colorblind constitutionalism.
And does that extend throughout the government, or is it appending the question in Congress?
No, it extends throughout the entire government. And so I think maybe for your listeners, it's just important to understand one very important point. I think when a lot of people think about affirmative action, they think universities. In fact, the first application of affirmative action was the federal government in its contracting programs. And that may seem like it's sort of like in the weeds. If you go back to the late 1960s, early 1970s, when the Nixon Labor Department was saying, if you are a federal contractor, you need to mirror the demographics of your local community. Well, guess what? In 1970, one third to one half of American workers worked for a federal contractor. Federal contractor is just a company that is doing business with the federal government. It doesn't mean that that's the only counterparty that they're doing business with. This covered so much of the private economy. So George Shultz, again, back to him, brilliant Princeton grad, Marine, dean of the UChicago Business School. He really understood that, you know, there would be a major effect on the private workforce if the federal government sort of required these affirmative action programs through the contracting. So then that became the sort of the DNA of federal contracting, these kind of requirements. University affirmative action, boardroom affirmative action sort of followed from that. Now, in 2023, the U.S. Supreme Court ended university affirmative action. Again, another great opinion from the court following on this colorblind constitution trend of the recent court. Many companies, many private companies felt, hey, we may be next. So started voluntarily unwinding their DEI programs. The federal government, however, is like the first in and the last out when it comes to affirmative action. These contracting programs did not end with the Students for Fair Admission decisions in 2023. They continued throughout the end of the Biden administration. And then finally, with the current Trump administration, they've come in and they've said, we need to, as a federal executive, we can't wait for Congress to do it. The Labor Department belongs to the president. We're going to take action through the executive branch to return merit to federal programs. And that's the final piece of the puzzle that the Trump administration has done.
A note, I did see that though the admissions department had stopped the discrimination against Jews long before I arrived in the 60s, the stain of the discrimination lasted beyond the legislation. In other words, people would assume, don't apply because they'll reject you. They once did this for years. It damaged the university. It damaged the classes that did not suffer discrimination, but they acted as if they had or thought they had, and very much damaged the idea that there was equal justice in America. Is that likely to continue with this present regime? In other words, long after the government is stopped, the assumption will be that it is discriminating.
You know, I it's a very great point you're making, and I'm hopeful, you know, that we'll get to a point where the understanding is that things are based on merit. I mean, as to repeat the great line, you know, it's never too late to quit. And so I think, you know, it's about time that the federal government has sort of ended this 60-year experiment with preferences. That really ought not to have started in the first place. I mean, I think very highly of George Shultz in terms of his influence on American foreign policy. But, you know, this was, you know, an errant move on his part, where if you look at the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and I quote from Hubert Humphrey, from Clifford Case from New Jersey, from Joseph Clark from Pennsylvania, from the New York Times editorial pages, which everyone looked at the legislation and said, this will not lead to quotas. This will not lead to treating individuals differently based on their religion, based on their race. It was supposed to do the opposite. And almost immediately, we got away from the legislation in a 180 fashion. And so, you know, it's about time that we get back on track. And, you know, obviously, you know, as Ronald Reagan said, you know, the best days of our country can be ahead of us. So I think this is a new day for equality.
Michael Toth at Civitas. We turn next to A Mystery. I'm John Batchelor.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.